Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And this is Carol the Coach. Hey, Carol Jurgensen Sheets here with you tonight, Monday evening, 9 o'clock, every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it's been a couple of weeks, I have to admit. Last Monday was my birthday, and I debated on whether to do the show or not, and I said, Carol, it's your birthday, it's on a Monday, come on, you got friends that are coming over. And so I said, okay, I'll play back a show that I thought was very informative, very interesting, on the Feeling Addiction State Protocol. And, you know, so much of what we do as certified sexual addiction therapists is knowing the specific techniques, strategies, niches that will help you as a sex addict, or help you, if you love a sex addict, get better, quicker, faster. And I'm all about sharing that with you all, with the world, because there's not enough information disseminated at this point to do that. So Robert Miller is somebody that I trained with who believes that your sexual addiction may not be a result of sexual trauma reenactment. It may not be a result of compulsivity because of a habit disorder that started early on. It may be a result of a linkage to a positive experience that occurred earlier in your life. And I trained with the man because I thought it was an interesting hypothesis, as well as very possible that for, you know, 10-15% of you developed this experience as a result of a positive link, something that occurred in your childhood that was really positive. It perhaps made you feel included. It perhaps made you feel part of the crowd. And so his protocol, I think, is very, very intuitive. And I wanted you to hear that again. Now, I have to tell you, when a couple of weeks have gone by, I have I feel like I've missed the show. And it's been combined with the fact that I've actually been off work for almost a couple of weeks. Had some medical issues that I took care of, and I go back tomorrow. So I'm like chomping at the bit to talk about sexual addiction. I want to encourage you all to go to ITAP and or Gentle Path and look at their new blogging that they're doing. I happen to be a part of that. Many of you know that I blog for the Meadows. I blog on my website. I have YouTube videos where you can go to Sex Help with Carol the Coach, and you'll find videos for the addict and for the partner, you know, anywhere from 7, 10, 15-minute snippets on how you can make your life better. Now, you and I both know that that's not enough time to change your life, but it is absolutely enough time to give you a life skill that's very, very important. Being that I'm a therapist and a coach, I'm a big believer in life skills. And they are imperative in you getting healthier. For instance, there was a study on brain adapting to dishonesty that was published, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this because I don't oftentimes say this. It feels like a put-down, but the addicts I work with say this all the time. It's something that, well, the quote is, "Do you know when an addict is lying?" The answer is when his or her mouth is moving. And there is a lot of truth to that. You can't be an addict and be honest. You have to be an addict who is deceitful, who lies, who minimizes, who rationalizes, who lies by omission, doesn't share the truth. And people who experience that phenomena of being an addiction, of having that, know that they have to lie to everybody about everything. So there's this belief that dishonesty is an integral part of our social world and that lots of people lie. And yet truly what they're finding is that there's empirical evidence that there's a gradual escalation of self-serving dishonesty that creates neural changes in the brain. Behaviorally, it shows that the extent to which participants engage in self-serving dishonesty can increase with repetition. So here you are, and you're being dishonest so that you can continue to do what you need to do. And now they're finding that the brain neurocircuitry shows that the more you lie about things, the more the amygdala is sensitive to the history of dishonest behavior, and that amygdala can predict the magnitude of escalation of self-serving dishonesty on the next decision. The findings uncover a biological mechanism that supports a slippery slope whereby small acts of dishonesty can escalate into larger transgressions. And that's why it is so important when you're working on getting healthy and you are working on your program, that you be 100% honest about everything. I remember a friend of mine that we were dating at the time, and we just really enjoyed each other. And one day he came over, And I could sense something was wrong. Something was different about him. And I said, I'll call him Joe. Hey, Joe, what's going on? Something's wrong. And he said, I have started seeing somebody, and I believe it's going to be permanent. And I have not told her about you. And he said, one of the things I know is, he was in the program for AA. He said, one of the things that I know is by not talking to her about you, I'm lying by omission. And he said, and to come over here and to talk with you and be with you is even more lying. And he said, I'm working a rigorous program. And so what I know to be true is that something has to change. Well, what he had decided was he really cared for this person, and he could no longer have a relationship with me, even though we had a great time together, we had a lot of fun, because he would not be able to have that relationship with her. And he knew that. And so he was lying by omission by coming over to the house, but at the same time he realized, okay, I got to make this right. I've got to share with Carol what's going on. I've got to say I'm not going to do this. And I've got to give that man credit. We have been friends forever. And from that day forward, we had a totally different kind of relationship. It was really a tribute to his rigorous honesty. And so knowing that, I've got a lot of people out there that are dealing with addiction, and they're in all different stages of that addiction. I want to encourage you to practice rigorous honesty in every aspect of your life. When you do that, you really are working a program. And, you know, the 12-step program advocates for that. And so that doesn't mean that you can lie on your taxes and be honest about who you're with or what you're doing at 2 a.m. in the morning. It means that you become honest about every aspect of your life. And that's that spiritual transformation that takes place. And I know that it can feel like, wow, I have so much to lose. My life will be way different. But I got to tell you, you have so much to gain, because it will really make a difference in how you feel about yourself and who you show up to be. And that is about rigorous honesty. Now, tonight, I have a guest who's back on, Jonathan Taylor. You may remember Jonathan because he talked about some tools that he uses to be honest and to talk with people about intimacy. And he had referenced talking with people about how do you navigate this whole thing with teens, and what happens if you're afraid that your teen may be acting out sexually, you know, maybe developing some sexual compulsivity. And I asked him to come back on the show, and then, as if that wasn't enough, he and another colleague have started their own podcast on sexual addiction. And so I said, hey, Jonathan, you got to come on the show. We got to talk about how to talk to teens, how to navigate parenting, and as well as you got to tell us a little bit about your podcast. So, Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carol.
Yeah. Now, tell me a little bit about your work with teenagers. I mean, obviously, you have a niche with sexual addiction, but working with teens is a very specialized niche. Do you believe that teens can be sex addicts?
That's kind of tricky. That's actually where I got my start in working with sexual issues, is working with teens with sexual issues. And as I was starting out, there was a lot of talk around, you know, my teen's a sex addict, my teen's addicted to porn. And I think those two words together are really, really scary for parents. So when I got my start in this field, that's kind of what I jumped right into the middle of. I think it's important with teens to recognize that it's a really exciting time in their life and a really complex time in their life too. So to boil down a teen's sexuality to whether they're addicted or not, I think is a little too reductive, and we have to do a lot of investigating and a lot of looking at different aspects of their life and different things that are going on in their life to determine what is going on for them if they have sexual behavior that they're concerned about, or if, as a parent, you're concerned about your teen's sexual behavior.
Well, I think that's a great way to formulate that. I know for most any addiction, there has to be a certain level of repetition and dependency and experience to actually create that neural circuitry that also reinforces the addiction theory. But you and I both know that if kids have been looking at pornography from ages 8, 9, 10, 11, and if they've been doing it daily, multiple times a day, there certainly is a sexual compulsivity that is heading in that direction. And it really doesn't matter whether we call it sex addiction or sexual compulsivity. It remains a problem. Now, let me ask you, how does your work with teens differ from your work with adults?
So with the teen, one of the things that excites me most about working with teens is just how much is changing and developing in their lives. I really like in working with teens that they come with a lot less of a solid understanding or a lot less of a solid perception about who they are. And when it comes to their sexuality, you know, they're still discovering that. So with teens, I feel like it's really important to foster that environment where they can do some safe exploring and some safe considering of different feelings and relationship arrangements and things like that, and really kind of taking a role as kind of the guide on the side who helps them to examine what they're experiencing, helps them to examine what they're feeling, and then helps them to determine based on their own morals and their own experience what's going to work and what isn't going to work for them. I think another thing that's pretty different in working with teens is that it's really crucial that the family get involved early on. One of my favorite teen groups that I ever ran, we added a monthly family component. So I would meet with, it was a group of teenage boys, I would meet with them 3 weeks out of the month, and then once a month, we would bring in both parents. We made that a part of the one of the requirements is that you, if you live in a two-parent home, that both parents come on this night. And we were really able to do a lot of not just educating about sexual compulsion or pornography addiction or things like that, but we really got to talk about how they connected with their parents and what some of the rules around connection were in their family. And that's something with adults, you know, I'm as much as some of my clients might want me to, I'm not going to call their mom and dad into the room to have mom and dad come fix things or own all their mistakes. But with teens, that's a big part of treatment is involving the family as much as possible, because that's really the group that the teen is going home to at the end of every day. And that's really where the teen is learning about relationships and connection.
Oh, 100%. And so, did you ever run groups for teens that were acting out sexually or seemed to manifest compulsive sexuality?
Yeah, that's probably the first 4 years of being a therapist. That's what I did primarily, was groups of teens that were dealing with sexual compulsivity, pornography, addiction type things.
Yeah, because I also ran a group for teens, and what I found was that they really wanted to talk to each other, and they did a really nice job of holding each other accountable for acting out behavior, because they understood. They knew because they had done it, had been there, whatever. Now, how did you integrate the parents? What did you end up doing to include the parents and not alienate the teens.
Yeah, that was tricky for sure when we proposed to the teens that we have a family component to the group. You know, we got reactions from, I don't care, to like, if my parents come here, I'm not coming back, sort of thing. And from the parents, we got some interesting responses too from some parents. We heard, you know, I dropped him off here for you guys to deal with him. Like, I don't want to come here and deal with him. So we really set it up in preparation for family night each month. We would ask the teens what's going on in your own healing and your own learning that you feel like is important to share with your parents. How can they be helpful to you? And there was a segment of that family group where we would have the teens talk to their parents. We would do kind of some breakout, and each teen would talk to both parents about what was going on for them and what their parents were doing that were working for them, like what was helping them out, and some things that they wanted their parents to take a closer look at and maybe reconsider some of their approaches. And then as a whole group, the parents and the teens together would talk about what they got from talking to each other and what they got from listening to each other. So really empowering the teens to have a voice in their family, which depending on the family that you come from and the teen that you are, that can be one of the things that contributes to some of the compulsive sexual behavior, is not really knowing how to manage your own emotions or how to speak up for yourself. So we really tried to empower our teens to do that. And with some teens and their families, that really took off and was very, very helpful. They learned how to talk to each other about these really difficult issues. And it really reduced the embarrassment for the teen. And I mean, frankly, the parents were a bit embarrassed too to talk that frankly about sex with their kids. But that was, we put the ball in the teen's court and really had them kind of lead out in how the parents were going to be involved.
Yeah, that, you know, in some ways that was really, really brave, because obviously they can talk to their parents, and you were the link to help kids talk to their parents and assert themselves and be honest and talk about feelings, and you helped the parents to receive that and probably promoted them doing the same. Now, did you
yeah.
see a correlation between kids not being able to talk to their parents and sexual compulsivity?
I don't know how strong it was. It was definitely common enough that was something that we really paid attention to. But that wasn't that wasn't the case with every teen and every family, that I've worked with, but it certainly is a big theme. When I have gone around to talk to groups of parents, that's one of the number one things that parents will say, is that conversation is really uncomfortable, not just for our child, but it's really uncomfortable for us. And I've recognized that part of this work, or even part of the maybe prevention side of helping families to be equipped with the emotional bandwidth and the emotional tools to kind of avoid some of the more sticky parts of pornography and compulsive sexuality, is empowering the parents to know what they know and to know what they don't know. So, you know, some groups of parents, we've had to work on some really basic, like, what's age appropriate for a kid's sexual development, or what's some age appropriate ways to talk about pornography or to talk about sex or sexuality. So it's definitely there, and it's something that's more often addressed than not with the parents and the teens and the families that I've worked with.
Yeah. You know, it sounds like you really get what teens need to be able to do to feel good. I don't know if you listened to the beginning of the show, but I really said that, you know, rigorous honesty is absolutely essential to working a program. And obviously when you're working with kids, with teens, they're not necessarily in any kind of program. But you're really helping
right.
them to be honest with their parents. And that then, you know, that old saying about you're only as sick as your secrets, that obviously alleviates
mm-hmm.
some of that for them.
Yeah, you know, like
so,
you were saying
so
in the group. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, like you were saying in the group that you had worked with, the boys really, or the teens you worked with did a really good job at stepping up and holding each other accountable because they understood it. I really liked watching the dynamic in the groups the first few weeks that they'd meet together, and everybody was figuring out that everybody there used porn a lot or, you know, had other problems with sexual compulsion. And just the amount of relief that they would feel when there was a place that they could go once a week to talk very openly and very honestly. For some of the kids that I've worked with, that's been one of the biggest factors in their being able to kind of live more aligned with their values or more aligned with how they want to live, is just having a place where they could be honest and that was safe for them.
Yeah, and so again, what do you think that professionals can do or parents can do, you know, for a teen who may be struggling with sexual compulsivity? I mean, what would the formula be? What would you encourage parents or professionals to do?
You know, I like to think it hasn't been that long since I've been a teenager, although in reality it has been. I remember one of my main drives was to not get in trouble or to not feel like I was in trouble. And so I think one of the first steps in that formula is really to develop a relationship where your teen, whether you're a therapist or you're a parent, where that teen can really trust you, and to know that when they come to you in honesty or in distress, that you aren't necessarily going to use what they tell you to punish them, but you will use what they tell you to help them. And sometimes that help can't be given immediately. Sometimes that help is that safe place to come back to again and again while they kind of explore and unfold. So I think that's a pretty important first step. Teens are very relationally based. I mean, you look at how I think school is much more of an exercise in them getting together and learning how to be social than it is them learning any facts or anything, which is a really important part of development. But, you know, with teens, when that, even with their friends, when that trust is violated, they're really on the outs with each other. They're really sensitive to how safe their relationships feel. So starting there, I think, is one of the ways that you start. It's hard to help somebody that you don't have a relationship with. So really getting into their world and getting to know them is an important first step. And that's something that I think you have to continually work on. It's not just a one-time thing. Like, you know, I talk with a lot of the teens that I work with about the video games that they like and the music that they like and the things that are important to them. And, you know, initially try to find some connections or some common ground. But that's not a one-time thing. That's something that we have to continually work on, is the not just having connection, but the quality of that connection. You have to do some vacationing in their world and kind of not just inviting them to come along with what you like to do or what you're interested in, but really getting into what they're interested in. I think that builds some really good relational and emotional capital with teens. I think a step beyond that, maintaining the relationship, is really get educated on what that teen's world is like. Like, know the apps that they're using, know how they're using social media and what social media means to them. I remember when I first got on Facebook, for example, that was the hub of internet social media activity. And I heard a couple years later, I was still going strong on Facebook, but apparently younger and quote-unquote cooler people were leaving Facebook because that's where all the old lame people went, and they were going to things like Snapchat and Instagram. I think really getting to know how they use technology, and because they use technology to connect with other people. And if you don't know what that looks like, don't just Google it. Like, ask the teen that you're concerned about what their social landscape looks like, why they connect the way that they do, and why that's important to them. And then I think when those three things, the listening and continuing to work on connection and understanding how they connect and want to connect, then I think with that foundation set, then you can really start to talk about information around sex and sexuality and getting to know what their concerns are, getting to know what their questions are. The research is pointing at a lot of teens are using a lot of porn and a lot of online sexual activity for sex education. They're simply curious and don't know where else to go to get it. I mean, that's what we do when we have a question. Now you Google it, right? But I think when you have a safe and connected relationship with a teen, you can really talk about some of those more important, sensitive, scary issues, and they'll actually open up instead of that knee-jerk reaction. If you try to go straight for the important issue or the sensitive issue, they're going to clam right up and you're never going to get in there again.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so much of working with teens, whether you're a professional or a parent, is really being open to where they're at and not being in any way judgmental or critical,
mm-hmm.
but really having empathy for what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. And it's so hard because I think of some of the teens that I know well and love a lot in my life. Teens are not known for their necessarily for their great decision making or their amazing foresight. So sometimes as you're talking to them, you really want to jump in and correct or give advice, but you really have to fight that impulse if you want to connect with them, because the developmental task of a teen is to figure out who they are separate from the authority in their life. So if you keep putting yourself in that authority position, hey, you should listen to me, or I've got advice on this, developmentally, they're likely to push back, even if it's good advice or even if it's something that they agree with. So you really have to kind of fight that tendency to give a lot of advice or, oh, wait a minute, let's not go there. Like, you really have to be patient and listen. And I found with teens, the more they know you'll listen, the more that they'll open up and the more they'll trust you with. But the minute that trust is violated, it's really hard to get back.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, that's why you really got to, go in with an honest heart. You can't be manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
You can't.
Mm-hmm.
And, a lot of parents, they are kind of manipulative. They don't mean to be, but they really feel like, well, if I say this, they may not say that, so I'm not going to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
really, you're just asking them to pay attention to the kid and to reflect back their feelings and to do that openly and honestly.
Yeah. You brought in the word manipulative in how some parents go about this, and I totally understand that as a parent. When I'm scared about what's happening for my kids, I'm going to get really crafty in how I'm controlling what's going on, because we go to control when we fear. So as a parent, this is much as a process of trust for you as it is for your kid, to kind of trust that process that says if I work on being open and genuine and honest with my child, they will come to me, or I'll be one of the people that they trust. Now, when you are kind of biting your tongue to avoid giving advice or telling what to do or, laying down the law, you're really taking a big gamble. And that's pretty scary. But I think with teens that, like I've been saying, that ability to listen and that ability to kind of let them lead to a large extent, it really does go a long way with them. But I think it's totally against the parent-child programming, especially when you're a parent who's concerned about the safety and well-being of your child.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Now, what do you think is not helpful when working with a teen who's struggling?
I would say the number one thing is any kind of shame. Shame is an emotion that we learn socially, and shame is what we learn when somebody disconnects from us. And that disconnection signals this. I think biologically what it signals is I've done something that's not helpful, I need to try again. But I think we've been conditioned for it not to refer to our behavior, but refer to who we are. So it's that I am a bad person, or I am something bad that nobody wants to be connected to. So any kind of shame, like the, hey, you know better, or what were you thinking, anything that makes that teen feel smaller and more and powerless, more than they already are, is really going to shut down any opportunity you might have to help them. And it also, we, one of the things that I know you've talked a lot about in your show is the connection between compulsive or problematic sexual behavior and shame. If there's an environment of shame, it may be more likely to feed the behavior that you're wanting to talk about or help with or adjust. So we've got to be really careful in how we come across and how we treat it. I think one of the things that I've heard from my teen clients over and over that is one of the least helpful things they get from their parents is when they have a big lapse with porn or when they are caught in behavior that is not safe for them. When the parents freak out, what the teen learns from that is, you can't handle what's going on in my life and you can't handle my emotions, so I'm not going to trust you with those. So shame can be a real killer to that connection. I think also a lot of parents, I've fielded a lot of phone calls from parents who just, you know, find me online and say, hey, I've got a teen looking at porn. How do I punish them for this so they don't do it again? And my answer is they don't need an artificial consequence. There are natural consequences to looking at porn. Like, do you know how your child feels about what they viewed? And most of the time, oh, I haven't thought to talk to him. I just found it and immediately searched for porn addiction therapist teen, and I found your name, and I thought you could tell me how to fix this. I think teens are highly attuned, and children in general, they're highly attuned to what feels good and what doesn't feel good. So before you run down the road of, okay, you're looking at porn again, so that means you don't get the car for 3 months or whatever, before you run down that road, really check with your teen first and see, what are they feeling? Are they already feeling some shame, or are they already feeling some consequence to this? Maybe that feeling they're having is going to be more effective at getting them to slow down and pay attention than anything that you could do. So I think it's important to check that out. I think also strict codes of conduct or strict moral codes telling them, you know, this is what you believe and this is what you have to do. Like I said, teens are programmed to individuate and programmed to kind of push back against the known so that they can kind of develop who they are for themselves. So I think a better option is to really sit and look at the teen, like what does this behavior mean to you and how do you feel about that and what does that feeling mean to you and what do you want to do with that? I've also seen my fair share of teens come into my office and I'll ask them, so what brings you here today? And they'll say, well, mom. And I'll say, well, why do you want to be in therapy? And they'll say, I don't want to be in therapy. Mom wants me in therapy or dad wants me in therapy. There have been a few of my teen clients that I've seen come back from that. But any time that there's this, you have to get help or else, that usually sets up a power struggle and a fight. And teens are really good at holding out to win power struggles. So when it comes to getting them the next level of help, I think it's really important to do that collaboratively. I've encouraged parents. There have been some parents that I've worked with on the phone for a few weeks before their teen ever came in, and we've been working on how they can empower their teen to choose the help that feels right for them. I've taken phone calls from teens at the suggestion of their parents and told that teen, this is an opportunity for you to talk to me and see if I'm someone that you even want to work with, see if you even want to open up. But anytime there's that, I'm the parent, I said, so dynamic, if you have a developmentally on track teen, you're likely to get them to rebel against that.
Yeah, and you know what I really like is you can hear a lot of self-respect and respect for the teen between you and the teen, and really, that's what teens want, is they want to be acknowledged, they want mm-hmm. to be validated, and obviously you're there to help them with that and also help the parent to recognize that. You know, parents come into mm-hmm. this feeling very scared, very anxious, very, mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of parents really believe that their child's behavior is really a reflection of their own parenting, which you and I both know is oftentimes not the case. And so when they're really worried about their kids, they're also really worried about where did I go wrong? How did I fail? And we're there to help them realize you didn't fail. It's about connection. It's about validation. It's about communication.
Yeah, and that's what lest any parent listening, you know, gets the idea as we're talking that they can really screw this process up. I want to put out there that I know it's scary when it comes to things that your kids are facing out in the world. My oldest this weekend just had his first run with the neighborhood pack, and the whole time he was gone, I was very nervous about, you know, I knew these kids and their families and the neighborhood, and I wasn't worried about him running into dangerous things, but I was like, I was thinking, you know, what if they picked him up to play baseball, and I was thinking, well, what if he doesn't hit the ball as well as they do and they make fun of him? And I found like I was kind of hovering anxiously as he was walking out the door to run around with friends. So I get that it's nerve-wracking and you care about your kids. And when we're in that big fear place, sometimes our gut reaction and our approach is not the most helpful approach. So I encourage parents to take a deep breath and think, if I were in my kid's shoes, what would I want? What would help me? And most adults would say, well, I don't want somebody to yell at me, or I don't want somebody to tell me what to do. I want somebody who will listen, or I want someone who will embrace me, or I want somebody who will let me know that they're there for me and give me an opportunity to come to them rather than, you know, coming in silence blazing and saying there's a problem, we got to fix it now. So that fear is normal, but most of the parents that I work with are actually pretty good intuitive parents if they can slow down enough to feel feelings besides the fear, besides the anxiety that they're feeling when their kids are having struggles with porn.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, the universal issue for a lot of parents is, if I talk to my child about sex, will that give them permission to have sex? And obviously with this niche, there's got to be a lot of parents who think, if I'm talking to my child about sexual problems, addiction, or pornography, will that put them at risk for going to find those sexual experiences? So let me ask you, have you ever seen that to be the case?
There have been, I've never seen it personally. There have been some anecdotal things that I've heard where a parent talks to their child about porn and then the child goes and gets curious and looks. However, that conversation was not age appropriate, and the conversation left a lot more questions than it answered. So I think as a parent, really looking at what needs to be shared and what's age appropriate and how available am I to answer questions afterward. Like if you're talking to your kids about sex the way that we, you know, see it in sitcoms, it's this really uncomfortable conversation in the car because you know the kid's not going to jump out of the car, and you both just kind of grit your teeth and get through it, and then you don't look at each other for a couple weeks after that because you're both so embarrassed and mortified that you talked about sex. I think in those situations, kids are going to end up curious and they're going to go searching. However, what we learned from kind of the alcohol and teens or teens not using alcohol movement is that when parents talk to their children openly and honestly and continually, those children are more likely to make decisions that are influenced by the family morals and the family expectations and, you know, the good things that the parents are teaching those kids to keep them safe than if the parents don't have the conversation. I think a big reason why a lot of teens go online for porn is because adults are not having conversations with them about sex. And, you know, most teens either have the internet in their pocket or it's very readily accessible to them and they can just go on Google and search for whatever they're wondering about. And then they get information about sex that may not have a relationship context or may not have a moral or ethical context. It's just about the sensationalism of sex. But when you give that relationship context to teens, they start, or even children, they start to evaluate what they're seeing against the context that you give them. Like my children are young, and we're starting the conversation around sex with them around things like consent, like yes means yes and no means no. And when you say no, I'll stop. And when I say no, you need to stop. And I'm hoping that as they grow up, that kind of becomes a template for relationships. And so that when they see relationships, or maybe they see online pornography and that element of consent isn't there, they can look at that and say, wait a minute, something's off there. And they can really start to evaluate for themselves and kind of make decisions for themselves. But that conversation really has to start pretty early, and it can't be that once and done conversation. It's got to be ongoing and open, honest, and adaptive. And there are some really great resources out there to help parents talk to their kids about this. One of my favorite books is What's the Big Deal About Pornography by Jill Manning. She just recently completed CSAT training, certified sex addiction therapist training. But prior to that, she's done a lot of research and writing around that. And this book is written to teens about online pornography. And she very adeptly puts in there some parts for parents, like now stop and have a conversation about this, or ask your teen about this. There's another really good book that we're using with my
small.
Her name is Jill Manning.
Okay, Jill Manning, and it's What is the Big Deal About Pornography?
Yep.
Okay, got it. That's good for parents to
know. And that book's actually, that book's probably about a decade old, and I'm sure since then there have been other great things written. But that's a great resource for parents to go to. If you want your kids to have access to good information, check out good information for yourself and then share it with them. So you know the kind of information that you're getting, and you know how to have conversations with them. There's another book for smaller children called Good Pictures, Bad Pictures. And it's all about teaching young children what pornography is in age-appropriate ways so that they can recognize it when they see it. Because I think our colleague Ken Adams will say he thinks that early exposure to pornography in and of itself is traumatic. And I believe that. I don't think the research has shown that yet, but anecdotally, I think that there's something to that. One of the things that we know that helps with trauma is when we have language to describe what happened to us, or language to describe what we saw. And small children are not great with language, but we can give them words that prepares them to talk about things that they will experience or things that they will see. And then they tend to be a lot more resilient. When kids don't know how to talk about what happened to them and they feel bad, they're likely to keep a secret. When something happens to them or they see something that doesn't feel good and they have a few words for it, they're likely to talk about it. So I think information is power and knowledge is power. So the more we talk openly with our children and more continuously we talk with our children, I think the more likely they are to come with questions and to come when there's first exposure to pornography, when it can be addressed and helped with a few simple changes rather than when it gets to be this very entrenched habit or even, on the edge of addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had the authors on Good Pictures, Bad Pictures, and I agree with you 100%. It's like any kind of education. When the earlier you start, the better, because oftentimes there's not shame or guilt attached to that.
Mm-hmm.
And giving kids an opportunity to learn certain words that describe experiences is really, really helpful. It's nice to have these resources. You know, again, for an older teen, somebody who's 16, 17, or 18, I know a church is an amazing speaker about some of the problems that can occur with chronic use of pornography. We've had him on the show.
Yeah, I've heard his name before. I also really like, for older teens in that 16, 17, 18 range, I really like Gail Dines and Culture Reframed, where she's not just talking about, I don't think she actually does a lot of talk about how pornography can affect the brain, but she talks about how pornography affects our relationships and how it changes how we view each other, which I think is another really important part of the education here. It's not just, you know, pornography may be addictive or it can change your brain. It's really, in the vast majority of pornography, there are messages about men and women that are not healthy or productive messages about men and women. And I think that's some of the information that we can arm our teens and children with early on, what healthy connection is and what healthy intimacy is, so that when they see something that's not that, they'll know it. And they kind of don't have to wonder, is this how relationships work? Is this what I'm supposed to experience? They'll already have a template for what healthy relationships and connection is.
You know, it's interesting because you said that Ken Adams had said that looking at pornography early in your childhood development can be traumatic. And I absolutely agree with that. But for our parents that are listening, or in actuality, for the addicts who are listening and the partners who realize that some of their pornography has probably showed up on computers and that their kids have probably seen their pornography. I also want to say that it can be traumatic, but the other thing is that it can be, and you know this is, it can be enticing, it can be taboo, it can be curious, it can be, as you said, traumatic, and any of those experiences can create the need for repetition. And, you know, the number one thing that the addicts that I work with, and this is of any age, say to me is, you know, it's not so much the pornography that I look at that is so enticing. It is that drive and desire to find out what else is there out there that I'm not seeing. And that's the same way for a young child or a teenager. They're curious and they're like, I got to get home after school and see what else is out there that I haven't seen yet. And that in itself obviously creates an addiction, but also feeds that desire for the unknown.
That's where I'm really impressed with my colleague Jackie, the one that I do the podcast with. I'm really impressed with the relationship that she's built with her children, and how they come to her. Sometimes she'll, you know, tell us around the office, my daughter was asking me about this or this came up. And I'm impressed with the amount of detail and the amount of candor that her kids come to her with. But knowing Jackie, I know that came, that was really hard fought. She's really focused on the quality of her relationships with her kids. And she's really focused on, you know, kind of regulating her own emotions when they bring her scary stuff and not freaking out. And, you know, her kids getting the sense that they can't come to her. So I agree. When kids are exposed to things, they get really curious. And if you know about that kind of exposure, I think it's all the more important to be able to talk openly and honestly and frankly, because how much better off will that kid be if instead of that curiosity driving and they get on the computer and, you know, access all manner of video and images, how much better off is that kid if they come to you and say, hey, I'm really wondering about this, or I can't get this thought out of my head, and you have an open and frank and connected conversation about what they're experiencing and what they're wondering, and you answer their questions. You know, we talk in addiction treatment that the banner cry of the addict is more, more, more. And I think when our addicts start to experience real connection, they're not as kind of panic and starved for it, like when they, you know, access pornography or act out, where it's kind of, I never get enough. When we get real connection or we get real answers or real knowledge, we don't really have that part of us that's saying, yeah, but there's more, we have that feeling of that's complete information for now, or that's complete connection for now. And when I need more, it will be here. And I can seek that in. I always tell my clients, whatever we're going to do, we're going to go through the front door. I can come through the front door for that information, or I can come through the front door for that connection instead of trying to sneak around and get it another way.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because we really are at the end of the show, and you and Jackie have started a podcast that sounds phenomenal, and you know that this show is all about educating our listeners about what else is out there that will help them to learn more about sexual addiction, partner trauma, and the experts in the field. So would you let our listening audience know what the name of your podcast is, how you can go about finding it, and then you know I'm going to get you on the show in December or January so that you and Jackie can both talk about the podcast that you're doing, because, I mean, this last one sounded phenomenal.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. The podcast is Thanks for Sharing, and you can find us in the iTunes podcast directory and the Google Play podcast directory, or you can go to www.thanksforsharingpodcast.podbean, bean like the food, podbean.com. I think we've got like 12 episodes up right now, and the focus of this podcast in the practice that Jackie and I work at together, we really believe in the power of relationships and the healing process. So this podcast is for all things recovery, relationship, and healing. And so we really try to explore a lot of different topics and aspects of recovery and try to bring it back to the relationships that we have and how we can use those relationships in our recovery.
Yeah, well, you know, Jonathan, you're always working on something that is amazing and helpful. And so just know that we will get you on in the next 90 days to talk about that podcast. And again, thanks so much for talking about how to talk with teens, because you and I both know, even in today's world, talking about sex is very tough for most parents to do, let alone talking about potentially problematic sexual behavior. So we need all the guidance we can get, and I really appreciate you coming on the air and talking about how parents can navigate through this kind of difficult situation.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and thanks for the good work you're doing.
Okay, you are welcome. I look forward to hearing from you, and we'll get you on in the next 90 days. You give Jackie our best, and keep doing the good work that you're doing.
Okay, bye, Carol.
All right, talk to you later, Jonathan. All right, so again, that was Jonathan Taylor, and he is an expert in being able to talk to kids and parents about all sorts of issues surrounding their sexuality, surrounding their pornography, surrounding their sexual curiosity, you know, and that's the important part, is that as adults, we need to face the situation in a mature, calm way. And I know that's tough, but I know that you can do it. So thanks for listening to tonight's show, whether you're an addict, whether you're a recovering addict, whether you're a partner, or whether you're a clinician. I was talking with Jonathan Taylor, and he has made it his goal to really work towards educating people about how to talk to teens. You can reach him at Jonathan@gmail.com. And his website is www.johntaylorlcsw.com. His email, another email for him is jtaylortherapy@gmail.com. So I will see you next week for more information. I missed you over the last couple of weeks and look forward to dialoguing with you soon. You are listening to Sex Health with Carol the Coach, and you can email me at carol@carolthecoach.com, and I will answer all your questions on the air or off the air. I'm here to assist you in getting information that we know that you so badly need. All right. As I say at the end of every show, there will only be one of you at all times, so I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself. Have a great week.